Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. You're welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining me. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. It's the Riff's... I guess our announcer just said that, didn't he? Our phone-in talk show. Been doing it for... It's been here a long time. Let me see. I think this show is in its 36th year. Wow. If you'd like to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. My personal website, Peter Werby. That's W-E-R-B-E.com, peterwerby.com. Most important number, though, 313-298-WRIF. It gets you on the air. Big news tonight, of course, Cheryl and Drew are the Dancing with the Stars champion. Right. I was hoping P. Daddy would take it. If you don't know what the hell I'm talking about, it's probably not worth it. But my wife and probably 30, 40 million other people were way into this. So they had this big dance contest. So it's another one of these sort of reality shows. Getting to out of the world of fantasy where most of us live, because it's most comfortable, isn't it? Out there in the real world, it's kind of scary. And a lot of times people listen to this program, sometimes even call 313-298-WRIF, and I realize that's not true with most of you. It's not true with most of you who call. I'm not trying to intimidate anybody. But they really aren't paying attention. They're really only reacting to me solely and reacting sort of off of little snippets that they've heard of the news or little bits of their prevailing attitudes without really looking at what's going on. And if you look at these news sites, I guess people don't read the newspapers anymore for international or national news. They just go online. And if you just go like, there's not any left-wing site or anything like that. Just go to, what is it, new? Go here. Wait a minute. I got it up here. Right. Where is it here? Oh, yeah. News.yahoo.com. News.yahoo.com. Or MSNBC or CBS or even Fox News, anything like that. And the news is truly frightening. Now, every once in a while, I get an email. People rarely say it on the air, but people often email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com and say, you sound like such a miserable person. All you do is talk about unhappy things and bring up all the bad stuff, and you're so critical and what have you. You must be a very unhappy person. Well, like most of us, I spend most of my time in very ordinary things. Both what I have to do to make my life happen in terms of work and washing my clothes and going to the post office and stuff like that, and the entertainments, going to concerts, listening to music, playing sports, watching sports, all of that. But this is a very special little venue here at Night Call. WRIF has provided this, 36 years for us to discuss the issues of the day. It's not the totality of our life, but it's an extraordinarily important part of our life. Although, as you may get later in what I have to say, some of this may expand to the totality of our lives. I'm actually have a portion, I'm trying to fight that that little bit in my life where I'm truly frightened. I know you're not supposed to be frightened. Just girly men are frightened, right? Us brave macho guys, we're not frightened of anything, are we? And why should we be? We're Americans. We fear nothing. We stand up to everything. Well, there are certain things that are just spiraling out of control. Everything from politics to war to the environment and resources that we depend on. And if we're not looking at that, so I mean, you could have worst case scenario. In fact, I even have a worst case scenario here. I may have read a portion of it last week. I was just coming off of a cold. I couldn't really talk or read on an extended basis. But there's worst case scenarios, and then you can back up from those and just see what portion of that is going to come true. I mean, obviously, if we don't fix certain things, we are going to face some difficulties. At best, we're going to face difficulties if we don't come to grips with our major problems and figure out some pretty creative ways to fix them. if you extend that, I mean, full-blown catastrophe. I don't know. What I don't want to predict that, but it's within the realm of possibility. And we have people at the helm of things that are absolutely incapable of seeing anything further than profits and political victories and money, and that will not work in terms of what we face. In fact, I think now often when I heard, what was the latest? Was it the ports being turned over to the United Arab Emirates, or was it this outbreak of civil war that everybody had been predicting, other than the people who made up the reasons for the war in Iraq? Remember, they said we'd be greeted as liberators. Now it looks like things are going to go into this full scale. Well, I mean, looks like it. It already is at full civil war, isn't it? Will it get worse? I don't know. What will Iran do? What will the United States do? The fact that Iran may arise as a nuclear power. Some of the militias, the Shiite militias that are pals with the Iranian government, they say if the United States attacks Iran, they will wage all-out war against United States forces in Iraq. These people have brought us to the edge of disaster and to the point that we're at these other precipices that they don't even realize, that they're incapable of discerning the problem, let alone thinking of some solutions. And I just started thinking, what are they going to break next? What are they going to break next? They have screwed up absolutely everything. And you've heard that a lot from me over the last few years. And we have to begin to start thinking solutions. And you say, okay, what are they, Pete? Tell us the solutions. You figured out everything that's wrong. I mean, it wasn't too difficult. Not I'm like some really wise man or anything like that. It was all out there. I just didn't get fooled by these criminal incompetents, these incompetent criminals that are in charge of our lives. I never got fooled by them. It was pretty easy. Remember what I was saying a couple of times as a way to go about deciphering what's true and what isn't true? When somebody gets on television and is trying to sell you something, I mean, you know that with the ads, right? It's the same thing when these politicians get up there, when Bushko gets up there. They are trying to sell you something. So immediately assume they're lying. You don't know anything about it, so you're at a disadvantage. Assume they're lying. And then work from there. Have that be your working hypothesis. They're lying. They're trying to pick my pocket. They're trying to frighten me. They're trying to get reelected. They're trying to start a war. All of it with no basis, and none of it with my interest in mind. It's always their interest. Remember, everyone on television and everyone on radio, I did say everyone, is broadcasting for their benefit. They're broadcasting for, might I say it, our benefit. It doesn't mean that you can't broadcast good, important, truthful things. But obviously, I'm here trying to sell you something, ideas. I'm trying to have an effect. This is for me, right? And well, I don't know. I mean, I don't get much out of it. But certainly the people that are selling things that wind up with huge political and monetary gain, they certainly are getting something out of it. So distrust everybody. Distrust me, too. I don't want to say, hey, I want you to distrust everybody in the media except for me. I mean, actually, in a way, I do believe that, but I couldn't sell that to you very well, could I? You have to have it across the board. And so if you want to do that, I mean, some of you have, and hopefully most of you, have independent sources of information and corroboration of those sources. So if I say something, you go, yeah, that's true, and I know it's true because I also know that da-da-da-da-da. I mean, others of you, I say something, and you have no capacity to refute it whatsoever, and so you write an email, and you say, stupid liberal socialist. Remember that from last week? Yeah, I mean, so that's the extent of it. I mean, this is just loyalty to one's betters and loyalty to the empire and loyalty to these symbols that manipulate you. So you would do better not even to speak in public, but whatever. But, I found this. Remember last week, and this was the big story last week, Dick Cheney off on one of his hunting trips that you and I are paying for, hundreds of thousands of dollars. He's got this medical team going with him. He's out there, 12, 16 hours before he reported shooting his pal in the face. And there's a lot of speculation when you're not trusted to begin with. So people are saying, they were out there with two women who weren't their wives, and they'd been drinking, and the worst possible stuff. But it's real typical of these rich guys that continually have these events in their lives. Whether it's shooting somebody in the face or lying about a war in Iraq that winds up with thousands and thousands of people getting killed and the situation all going to hell even worse. But as badly as many of us predicted. Right? I mean, you might want to do that too. If you go back 3 years and we're heading up to the third anniversary of Bush's illegal, unnecessary war invasion and occupation of Iraq, who was right and who was wrong? All the anti-war critics were right, and everybody in Bushco, Bush Incorporated, were wrong, dead wrong to the point of lying. All right? But there's little incidences as well. These little instances of corruption. Does anyone remember? I didn't remember. Well, here, I'll just read you this. This is from editor and publisher. It's the company that, or a news site that, I don't know, what is an industry paper. Here, this is, it may not have been as serious as Vice President Dick Cheney shooting a friend in the face, but new details that have emerged about President George W. Bush's bicycle accident in Scotland last July show that he, too, might have been guilty of a bit of recklessness that caused serious damage. The Scotsman, a leading newspaper in Scotland, reported Sunday that it obtained a police report on the early July accident when the president crashed into a Scottish police constable while cycling in the grounds of Gleneagles Hotel during the G8 summit. At the time, the focus of the U.S. press reports was on the president's injuries, a few abrasions. Yeah, he's always banging himself up, too, while noting that the constable had suffered, quote, very minor ankle injuries. And according to the newspaper, however, the police officer, known in the report only as Constable X, ended up on crutches and was off work for more than 3 months. Anybody remember from, they still read that in college? I think they do. The Great Gatsby, remember by F. Scott Fitzgerald about rich people and all that? There's something in there, isn't there? Somebody remind me that phrase, but they were always breaking things up. And this is very typical. This is very typical of what these guys do. Of course, like in everything else, in their business dealings and in their politics, there's never, ever any penalty. They never pay any penalty. Well, let's go a little to the ports. This is Bush handing over Bush Co. Now, let me just talk a minute about that. Is that clear when I'm saying Bush Co? I mean, this is a friend of mine, a talk show host, refers to the Bush administration as a Bush crime family. So that's already been taken. So I can't really use that one. But Bush Co. is it's a company. So what we have, instead of a government, is a business racket where all of its policies don't have anything to do with the wealth and security of the people of the United States, but rather enriching the corporations that they represent. So it's Bush Incorporated. It's Bush Co., the Bush Company. And so there's a number of things that are going on here. This is from Paul Krugman. Some say Krugman. I don't know. Paul Krugman in the New York Times a few days ago. Osama, Saddam, and the ports. The storm of protest, he says, over the planned takeover of some U.S. operations by Dubai Ports World doesn't make much sense viewed in isolation. The Bush administration clearly made no serious effort to ensure that the deal didn't endanger national security, but Krugman says that's nothing new. The administration has spent the last 4.5 years refusing to do anything serious about protecting the nation's ports. So why did this latest case of sloppiness and indifference finally catch the public's attention? He says, because this time the administration had become a victim of its own campaign of fear-mongering and insinuation. So there was this creation of this continual sense that we're under this mammoth assault, that we have to turn over every resource that the United States government has, mainly in this absolutely bloated, expanded war budget, to fight people that hijack planes with box cutters, right? They don't have weapons, but we're creating all these sophisticated weapon systems that that can't do anything about fighting insurgents in Iraq. I mean, yeah, they fly some drones over there and what have you. Let's see. Now the ports deal. Bush assures us that, quote, people don't have to worry about security. But after all those declarations that we're engaged in a global war on terrorism, after all the terror alerts declared whatever the national political debate seemed to be, whenever the national political debate seemed to be shifting to questions of cronyism, corruption, and incompetence, the administration can't suddenly change the theme song to Don't Worry, Be Happy. The administration also tells us not to worry about having Arabs control port operations. Quote, I don't want those who are questioning it to step up and... Sorry, I'm saying that wrong. Quote, I want those who are questioning it, Mr. Bush said, to step up and explain why all of a sudden a Middle Eastern company is held to a different standard than a Great Britain company. Because it was a Great Britain company that previously owned this. This is who bought the Dubai company. The Dubai Ports World bought it from an English company that was controlling management of all these ports. Krugman says, of course, Bush is being evasive. This isn't just a Middle Eastern company. It's a company controlled by the monarchy in Dubai, which is the authoritarian United Arab Emirates, one of only three countries that recognize the Taliban as the legitimate ruler of Afghanistan. The rest of the stuff you know about them as well. Well, now the Bush administration said today that it will accept an extraordinary offer by the United Arab Emirates-based company to submit to a second and broader U.S. review of potential security risks in its deal to take over significant operations at six leading American ports. And they say they will appoint an American as head of security. Anyways, it's the Coast Guard. But this just doesn't sit well with people, does it? By the way, if you'd like to comment, 313-298-WRIF. The announcement means the White House won't have to face this revolt by fellow Republicans. Let's see. The company said that during the renewed security scrutiny, or until May 1st, a London-based executive who is a British citizen would have authority over DP World's U.S. operations. Okay. So we got somebody from Britain will be managing our ports. In another article in the New York Times, written by a couple of people, they say in an outcry over who should run America's seaport terminals, one clear trend appears to have been overlooked. American companies began withdrawing decades ago from the unglamorous business of stevedoring, ceding the now booming industry to enterprises in Asia and the Middle East. Apparently, there was two companies that were bidding to run our ports. The first one, as we know, was the DP World, and the other was PSA, the world's second largest port operator, is part of the Singapore government's investment arm. So you see what's happening here? I mean, isn't everything just beginning to drift away from us? I mean, shouldn't we consider, remember I got that from the great Gatsby, mentioning Gatsby. Doesn't anybody, come on, don't you still read that in English? What did they say? They just want to break everything up, but they just, you know, talking about the rich, they love to break everything up, something like that. But the other thing was, Gatsby was willing, he lived in, what was the name of his town, in that Great Egg, which is really, I think, Great Neck, Long Island. And the great Gatsby said he would pay all the taxes of the town if they all agreed to thatch their roofs, all right? To appear to all the world as peasants. That's the way things are going here. Now, the acquisition price also reflects the advantage that a number of the fastest growing companies enjoy. Their government's deep pockets. DP World paid about 20% more than analysts thought the company was worth. Publicly traded companies that were potential bidders were scared off long before DP World's final offer. So having the advantage of government financing, all that oil in the United Arab Emirates, they were able to outbid way beyond what the company was worth that they were buying. So when it comes down to operations, what is going to be their major focus? Well, recouping their loss, their return on investment. This is what happens with privatization. So things that should be within the public sphere, so that there should be public ownership of most things like that, it turns out to be private, and they don't care about port operations as much as they care about what? Huh. They care about profit. Now, let's think, too. Here's another story. The UAE, this is from Inter Press Service, jolted by port deal is key Western arms buyer. The United Arab Emirates, the center of a growing controversy over its proposed management of U.S. port terminals, is one of the world's most prolific arms buyers and a multi-billion dollar military market for both the United States and Western Europe. So what's going on here? The United Arab Emirates, this energy-rich Persian Gulf nation, is taking delivery of about $8.4 billion worth of military equipment. And, of course, the United States is selling it to them. Now, this is the United Arab Emirates. This is not the Democratic Republic of whatever over there. These are Emirates. These are monarchies. And why in the hell do they want these airplanes? And why is the United States arming this volatile region of the world? It's on a knife's edge as it is. So this is what I mean. These short-term gains turn out to be the basis for these long-term disasters. Let's see, they're going to take 80 U.S.-built F-16EF fighter planes. Whew. And U.S. President George Bush's threat to veto any attempts to block last week's deal permitting a state-owned UAE company to take over the management of six U.S. port terminals has underlined the significance of the political and military relationships between the Bush administration and the United Arab Emirates. Also, and this is endless, by the way, this is absolutely endless. This is the depth of scandal that typifies the era in which, rather than the economy being something that you and I have a direct handle on, is so far out of our control, has so far run away from our control, maybe it was out of their control even, that we have this monster system that makes its own dictates and cares nothing about the individuals, you and I, our families, our community, our country, and certainly nothing about things like the environment. David Sirota, who you should read all the time, I would say. His last name is S-I-R-O-T-A. David Sirota, I've interviewed him before. Says, the true motives of Bush's positions are starting to slip out almost inadvertently. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said about the UAE deal that, quote, we have to balance the paramount urgency of security against the fact that we still want to have a robust global trading system. So what this very much is about is trade. It's about trade. Two more things. Here, this from the very conservative Daniel Griswold, directs the Center for Trade Policy. Pardon me, at the Cato Institute. United States trade relationships with the UAE is the third largest in the Middle East after Israel and Saudi Arabia. The two nations are engaged in bilateral free talks that would liberalize trade between the two countries and would, in theory at least, allow companies to own and operate businesses in both nations. So we'll have more UAE ownership here. According to Griswold, there are legitimate security questions to be asked, but it would be a mistake and really an insult to one of our leading trading partners in that region to reject this commercial transaction out of hand. So they don't care about security. It's not what's going on here. According to John Nichols, who writes in The Nation, something else I would suggest checking out considerably often, the problem with the Bush administration's support for a move by the, you know, is not that the corporation in question is Arab-owned. The problem is that Dubai Ports World is a corporation. It happens to be a corporation that is owned by the government of the United Arab Emirates, a nation that served as an operational and financial base for the hijackers. But you know, even that, even if the sale of operational control of the ports to this firm did not raise security alarm bells, it would be a bad idea. Ports are an essential piece of the infrastructure of the United States. That's where we live. And they are best run by public authorities that are accountable to elected officials and people these officials represent. But not, you know, I just saw a movie last night down at the Art Institute, which is too bad there wasn't about 100,000 people watching it. It's called Why We Fight. Why We Fight. And without, and it was essentially making all this these points that what's leading all policy decisions by Bushko are corporate economic ones. Remember this populism, the interest and rights of the people. That's us. That's what populism is. That's what we need because we are the people. And then there's corporatism. In its most extreme form of corporatism, of course, is fascism. And that is where undemocratic institutions run all of life. So we still are kind of scurrying around at the bottom levels and get out the vote and all that. But as we can see, the big decisions that affect us all are all made by the elites with no democratic control whatsoever. Well, I'm remiss to not remember the man that that spoke these words in the film, the documentary. An astounding film, an absolutely astounding film. If it has commercial release, I would say go see it. But he said, and this was a very, very respectable guy, not just a crazy rad like me or something. But he said, right now we are in a contest. This is going to strike some of you pretty pretty strange. Boy, this is weird. I see this up on the board. But between capitalism and democracy, people saying the C word again, actually beginning to examine what's the nature of capitalism as a economic system and how it affects political decision making. Well, now, because of the concentration of wealth in so few hands, that it is undemocratically administered. It's not the 1840s. It's not the mythologized land of even the 1920s and 30s or 40s and what have you. It's big capital that controls everything. So, what do we do? By the way, I'll just one other little piece. Dubai company set to run U.S. ports has ties to the administration. What one of the guys that were saying, yeah, it's okay. It's okay that they had this security committee. One of them was Bush's Treasury Secretary, John Snow, whose department heads the federal panel that signed off on the sale of an English company, the government-owned Dubai Ports World. He was the chairman of CSX, not the radio station. He was the chairman of the CSX rail firm that sold its own international port operation to DP World for $1.15 billion in 2004. So about a year and a half ago, Snow was the chairman of the firm that sold the port operations to DP World. I mean, this is such a racket. I mean, who's out there that says, oh, this is okay. I don't care, you know. Well, I mean, there's some of you. There's a few of you listening that if I had films of Bush taking part in cannibalism, you would still go, well, it's because he's, you know. What have you? There's also the other connection, David Sanborn, who runs DP World's European and Latin American operations, and he was tapped by Bush last month. That's the good stuff. I'll get to the stuff that's really problematic, really troublesome in a little while. I'm Peter Werbe. My number here, 313-298-WRIF, and, a lot of people say, well, gee, that's hopeless, man. Those people are so big, so powerful, they control everything under the sun. Why should we even try to resist them? Read Orwell's book, or haven't read it since you're in high school, go read it again. He wrote it about Soviet communism, Soviet Russia, and now it's all about us. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Xavier in Santa Cruz, California, one of my favorite cities. Xavier, oh, wait a minute, I got to do this myself. Hold on here. I have to push the little buttons. Let's get Xavier on. Hi, Xavier. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Peter, and I, in turn, used to live in Michigan, too.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, I wish my dad was listening to this. He's a right-winger, though.
Wow. You're lucky you're out there. It's like 16 degrees now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I wanted to make, and this seems really obvious, but I don't hear anybody else saying this, is under communism, supposedly the state takes over business and, you know, owns everything.
Yeah.
But what seems to be happening here is business seems to be taking over the state, and the net end result of both systems is the same, the merging of the two.
Sure, that's actually an interesting point. Actually, I never would have said it was communism or socialism in the Soviet Union or China or any place like that, but rather a state capitalism of the type that we see in the United Arab Emirates. Is the state is the entrepreneur, the state is the employer, the state is the investor. It pays wages, it tries to drive wages down to their lowest point. It's like any employer.
You know the situation with Dubai, isn't that a state-owned business, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so a lot of these right-wingers, you would think that they would have a problem with that, seeing as how that's, doesn't that sort of equate to their idea of what communism is, or no?
Well, Xavier, a lot of right-wingers, particularly right-wingers, not just conservative, most right-wingers were opposed to this. And a good number of the Republicans, because they're terrified that Bush, with all of his mistakes, were his successes, are going to drag down the whole party in the elections in November. So a lot of them are trying to put distance between them. So when you have somebody like Bill Frist, the head of the Republicans in the Senate, saying, I don't like this deal, you know, whoa, something's happening here. But Bushko needs this. I mean, what I was saying earlier about this whole idea of trade and having Middle Eastern investment. These guys, wealth is beginning to shift. So there's this enormous billions of dollars of possible investment. And the other way, it used to be U.S. capital always penetrated these other areas. Well, it's going to be the other way. And it's going to harm us. The penetration of foreign capital into the United States for investment, where they operate businesses here and take out the profits, is going to hurt us the same way that U.S. capital penetrating other foreign markets did during the 20th century. But of course, what was always left, and the best examples are the Latin American countries, is you had a very small class of rulers that cooperated with the foreign investors. So in Central America and South America, you had this very small rich elite that cooperated with the penetration of Yankee investments, and they made out pretty well. But as we can look at the continent, most of the countries have enormous populations still in poverty. All right, Xavier, thanks for calling. I'm going to move on. Thanks for calling from way out in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, when I was down in Venezuela, I forgot about that. I met all these people from Santa Cruz. They were almost all ex-priests. They were great guys. And, a couple of women, a couple of ex-nuns as well, who were at Mary. I hope if you guys are listening, you don't mind me telling your story. But we hung out with them a lot. All right, we'll take a break. There's open lines. And also, I want to talk, too, when I come back, because this hasn't seen either I covered it all, or there's nobody out there that says, oh, yeah, George W. Bush made a wonderful decision inviting this Dubai-based company in. So maybe we'll move on, unless you want to discuss it more. But the South Dakota legislature is just completed a bill that would completely ban abortions in that state. Yeah. So we'll talk about that when we come back. 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. A couple of emails here relating to this ports issue. Robert in Port Huron writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He's talking about the Fuhrer over Bushco selling our major seaports to a company. Doesn't the UAE have ties to Al-Qaeda? No, it doesn't have ties. A couple of the guys were from there from September 11th, and they laundered some money through there. Wouldn't this deal with the UAE bring about more of the terrorism that Bushco claims that they are protecting us from? Or is this yet another piece of the Bushco grand scheme of things? When is Congress going to show a spine and impeach Bushco? Well, I tell you, Robert, I think the only chance is that if there's a Democratic Congress elected. But still, these guys are going to be around screwing things up without anyone putting a brake on them till January 20th of 2007. And Bush is going to be in there unless we drive him out or he has the decency to resign till January 20th, 2009. Dave from Dearborn writes, great show, according to the New York Times. It's actually 22 ports, not 6 that are in question. Is that true? Hey, the New York Times. Without reading this one first, if it's short, Andy from Windsor writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I was wondering if you knew how many foreign ports the Americans own and where. We seem to only hear about foreign ownership of U.S. ports, not the reverse. Andy, I don't think any. Or if there are, it's very, very few that these United States companies have just gotten completely out of the biz. All right, well, I said I was going to talk about this South Dakota lawmakers approving a ban on nearly all abortions. And what they're trying to do is set up this deliberate frontal assault on Roe v. Wade at a time when these right-wing activists see the U.S. Supreme Court as more willing than ever to overturn the 33-year-old decision that gives women their own right to choose and tells the government to get out of their womb. What the hell? I mean, these probably 90% men passed this law that's going to affect women. I can't believe this. Republican Governor Mike Brown said he was inclined to sign the bill that make it a crime to perform an abortion unless it was necessary to save the woman's life. The measure would make no exception in cases of rape or incest. So if your 14-year-old daughter is raped and she's impregnated, she has to then, according to law, carry the baby to full term. And according to, Krista Heron-Graber, executive director of the South Dakota Network Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault, she says if a rape victim becomes pregnant and bears a child, the rapist could have the same parental rights as the mother. She says the idea that the rapist could be in the child's life makes the woman very, very fearful. Sometimes they need to have a choice. But these are right-wing fanatics that are compulsory pregnancy advocates. You will have the baby even if you don't want to. We have decided you will have the child, right? Leslie Unruh, president of the Alpha Center, which tries to steer women away from abortion, said most of the abortions performed in South Dakota do not stem from rape or even failed contraception. They are simply conveniences. Well, how the hell does she know? And secondly, what business is it of hers? See, that's why these conservatives, these right wingers that always talk, get the government off your back and all that, they don't take care of their own business. They're busybodies. They're into other people's business. You don't want to have an abortion? Don't have one. You think that life begins at conception? Good. Then don't have an abortion. Gently try to convince people that they shouldn't. You make some arrangements to take care of their kids and all of that. Unruh said she believes how the hell does she know? Most South Dakota women want the state to ban abortion, and many who have had abortions wish someone would have stopped them. Well, you know, you do get that sometimes, but so what? I mean, let's empower people with the ability to make their own choices. And sometimes when you do that, you make choices later. You think, I wish I hadn't made that choice. Gee, when I was 14 and was raped, I really wish I would have had that kid. You know, you might have somebody saying that. And, you know, it's not going to stop abortion. In this hemisphere, there's only three countries that have legalized abortion, right? It's the United States, it's Canada, and it's Cuba. So all the rest, the tens, hundreds of millions of people, I don't know how many people total, in all of those countries south of Texas, abortions are illegal. So what do you think? There's no abortions there? They don't have any abortions, right? Because it's illegal. It stopped it, right? Of course not. You have these illegal abortions in the hundreds of thousands where women's health is at risk. And what really you need, the people that that oppose abortion, and I mean, who's, quote, for abortion? I mean, it's not, if everybody loves children. Well, create a world in which all children are welcome. Allow contraception to be universally available to everyone. So the two things, contraception available, including things like the morning after pill, and also create an economic situation where women want to bring kids into the world. Probably the biggest impetus, outside of maybe the United States, but particularly in Latin America, the impetus for abortion isn't convenience, but rather economic deprivation. Women cannot afford, families cannot afford another child. Chris writes in to calltalkyes at yahoo.com from Grosse Pointe. South Dakota is making a splash with their abortion law. I always question why there is both a North and South Dakota. Sure seems like they get twice the senators and electoral votes for the same basic area with no people. What a scam. Is anyone listening? Anyone listening in the Dakotas? So you have this fairly empty region that has four senators, right? What do they have? Maybe one representative per state? Yeah, it is a scam. All right, let's go to John in Ann Arbor. John, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Pete. How are you?
Doing good. Thanks for calling in.
Bear with me, bro. This whole deal. Peter, you ever heard a saying called paying the piper?
Sure. He who pays the price, wait a minute, he who pays the piper calls the tune.
There you go.
Yeah.
And in this case, for better or for worse, the piper happens to be, in my opinion, the United Arab Emirates, if I'm saying that wrong or right. And the Bush administration is the piper. I mean, is the payee, okay?
Well, actually, you and I are the payee.
Okay, all right. This is a bad call. I mean, there is no reason why American citizens, this United States, would have to give up 22 of perhaps our most sensitive ports in all the United States. I mean, 22. And a few of them happen to be military ports. Now, I've heard on different talk shows that American companies own less than, say, 10% of control ports. In other words, foreigners control 90%, Native American companies control 10% or less.
Yeah, I've heard 20, but whatever. The United States companies, like so many other industries, we have just gotten out of the business, essentially.
Okay. But see, the other problem is, how can we do business with a government when technically we're still at war in Iraq, and some of those militants have financial connections?
Yeah, but those guys are buddies. I mean, that's the kind of buddies that Bush Co. likes. They're like the Saudis. They are rich oil sheikhs. I mean, even though they have a monarchy and they have these very repressive governments that want to be armed to the teeth, Bush doesn't have a problem with that. All right, John, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Matt in Westland. Matt, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two things that are a little off subject.
No, there's no off subject. If you're as ADD as I am, go crazy.
Well, like, you know how with, like, the crazy leaders in other countries, like Hitler, there was an assassination attempt on him, and he didn't get killed. And yet, The people who try to do good in the world get killed.
Yeah?
I don't understand how that works.
Well, I don't know. I mean, whose memory do we rever more? Gandhi or Martin Luther King or people like that? Or the people that, Henry Kissinger or somebody like that, you know, or Richard Nixon?
Yeah.
So, I don't know, maybe there's some karmic, cosmic justice eventually. But it does seem that the toll is taken on the good. I mean, thinking about how the poor suffer in the world and the wealthy, these multimillionaires that run a government like Rumsfeld and Bush and Cheney and those guys. There's got to be some justice somewhere. I agree with you. All right, thanks, Matt. Let's see some open lines for you, by the way. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Bill in Romulus. Bill, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Glad to talk to you. I've been admiring you since the ABX days and
oh my God,
ever else you've been. But I grew up in a liberal family. Well, split, actually. My dad was Republican. My mom was Democrat. So I've been exposed to both ideologies, and I've always fancied myself to be an independent, but the atrocities this administration has made just boggle my imagination. I'm a Christian. I profess to believe in the Bible and Jesus Christ, and I just, when George Bush says Jesus Christ was someone that he uses as his role model, it's just, to me, it's reprehensible. The acts he's enacted on both our country, Iraq, and the world at large, I can't believe. I have a lot of friends who are, I would consider, borderline, well, they're probably, you know, close to what we consider the Christian fundamentalist group.
Mm-hmm.
And I argue with them incessantly about what I've just said. How can you back this man who, just by his actions alone, has you know, gone against everything that we read, that I read in the Bible? I said, well, you know, who is your God, and how can I just, I don't understand it. I can't, I know there's people that are against abortion. But I say, you know, being a Democrat in this country is closer to what the values, altruistic values that Jesus professed to, which is taking care of the poor, helping those oppressed, helping the people out of poverty, and just diametrically opposed to the corporation nature of that, what this country's become.
Well, you know, Christianity, of course, has always had a pretty mixed history.
Oh, it's brutal. But I mean, the lessons Jesus taught should not be perverted.
Well,
the way it's been. I mean, I know.
Well, here, I mean, mostly we've, because of Bush and because of the prominence of these right-wing Christians over the last 5 years and the way they've been elevated to power in terms of their ideas way beyond their numbers, we tend to see Christians in this country as being right-wing, which isn't the case at all. In fact, hold on here. I think this cold is gone. People tell me it lasts 3 weeks. I guess it does. You can remember this easy enough. There's a website called commondreams.org, commondreams.org. Or you can even go to my website, peterwerby.com, and it's on there. And there's a story I'm looking at of it right now called U.S. Christian Leaders Apologize for Iraq War. And as Christian leaders from the United States lamented the war in Iraq and apologized for their government's current foreign policy during the Ninth Assembly of the World Council of Churches in Porto Alegre, Brazil, which ended on Thursday. So there's this long article, and these are mainstream churches, including Bush's church. I think, actually, I was reading this last week, but I don't know, this article just appeared on here now. So there's lots of support for the kind of ideas you have, for the liberal social message that Jesus had. So, I mean, it's kind of, I don't know, maybe it's like the blind men and the elephants. It depends on where you touch. All right, I'm going to move on. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Here's Jordan and Taylor. Hi, Jordan. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment about Bush and the war in Iraq and everything. I just think it's ridiculous we're still over there. I mean, we did what we had to do. We went in there, and we didn't find no warheads or anything like that. So I really don't think there's any point in being there anymore.
Well, it's just getting worse, isn't it?
Exactly.
In fact, it's getting horrible to the point where if you start looking at worst-case scenarios, the possibility of civil war, the ability of Iran to become the dominant power in Iraq grows and grows.
Right.
All right, but did you ask this? Because this is the million-dollar question. How do we get Bush out of office, right?
Exactly. That's my whole... That was my whole question of the conversation. I mean, just how do we get him out? So yeah. It's going to end up being like Nam.
Well, I'll tell you, it's thrown back upon us. We can't depend on the Democratic Party. Well, the Democratic Party would begin to move under certain circumstances. But, for instance, coming up next week and the week after, there's going to be demonstrations, hundreds and hundreds of them, again, all around the country and all around the world. March 18th is going to be the third anniversary of Bush's illegal, unnecessary invasion and occupation of Iraq. There's going to be a lot of local demonstrations. If you've never been to those are the ways that we begin to connect with one another on a face-to-face, person-to-person basis. There's a lot of value to email, but ultimately reconstructing our communities as they used to be, where people met people and talked and met in big halls and there were meetings and discussions and rallies, that is what we need to do to recreate civil society rather than us all being these scattered individuals, because there's nothing that Jordan from Taylor can do by himself. There's nothing that I can do by myself. There's nothing that we listening to this broadcast jointly can do by ourselves. It has to be translated into real world connections. And people say, oh, you know, millions of people came out. The largest demonstrations in the history of the world took place right before the war, and Bush didn't do anything other than what he wanted to do. Well, you don't always win right away. It's not like there's going to be, boom, you know, you go out and demonstrate, or you go to a rally, go to a meeting, and suddenly you have your way. I mean, as we saw in the Vietnam War, it took the deaths of 60,000 Americans and 3 million Indochinese at the hands of Johnson and Nixon before the United States finally got out of there. But it was the anti-war forces on every level, no matter how it was constituting itself and what kind of activity, that eventually forced the United States to stop making this war 8,000 miles away and this one 6,000 miles away. We did it once. We can do it again, but we have to do it. All right, I got to take a break right now. I'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
Right on, you rock.
You're at 1 minute on the riff.
Buy at the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Downloaded right to your PC.
Your riff rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rock, rock,
rock. You're listening to WRIF.com.
RiffRock.com. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Hi, thanks a lot. Welcome to our second hour. At 1 a.m., I'll be airing a couple of interviews that I did earlier this week. One, let me see, I got to do this all my memory. I mean, it wasn't so long ago. Patricia Campbell, Vice President of the Independent Workers Union of Ireland. And a pretty interesting lady. Great accent, of course. And. What's the second one? I don't know. I'll think of it. Let me see. Book. Oh, yeah. Oh, this is great. What was his first name? Hogan's his last name. And he wrote a book on the National Negro Leagues back in the teens and the 20s and the 30s and the 40s when baseball was segregated. They had this vibrant African-American baseball league. In fact, several of them, including a great Detroit team called the Detroit Stars. And so this guy who wrote a book. He got a big grant from Major League Baseball and the Office of the Commissioner. So anyways, that's at 1 a.m. Eastern Time coming up. Well, let me see. Okay, if you're on hold, just hold on 1 second. I'll just do a quick little deal. Big story is what? The Dubai ports, the fact that everything is going to hell in Iraq and probably will get worse. Or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it won't. But the United States got to get out of there. It's got to get out of the Middle East entirely. Take all of our toys, don't give anybody any more aid. Maybe we could set up a conference where we could start on a new path of peace. But arming everybody, trying to suck oil out of every country we can, making all these alliances with these monarchies, it's a prescription for disaster, and we're starting to see that now. But here's another potential disaster, and this was in the news, but not sure that it has the impact that one would think. Saudi Arabia said Sunday that two suicide bombers killed in a foiled attack in the world's biggest oil processing complex were on its list of most wanted extremists. So that happened a couple of days ago. And what was going on? These two men were on the list of the 15 most wanted terrorists in the kingdom. And on Friday, the first ever on Saudi Arabia's vital oil infrastructure could have been devastating. Nearly two-thirds of the country's oil flows through this complex for processing before export. If that would have happened, I can only begin to tell you what that the impact on the world oil market. And you may remember, as it was, oil prices jumped $2 a barrel on news of the foiled attack. So we're paying that. Did you notice the oil just went up in the last couple of days? But last week, I was reading a bit from this article called The Permanent Energy Crisis, talking about these things that occur, and these things like the ethnic violence in Nigeria, threats by Iran to cut off exports of oil and gas in retaliation for any sanctions imposed by the UN. This could have devastating effects on our economy. And so you might say, okay, well, we're all going to be a little poorer. That's not so good. We'll roll with it. Happened in the 70s. We dealt with it. But we have either reach the point of peak oil production, or we'll reach it soon. And I'm sure we're going to reach it soon because most of these countries are pumping at 100% of their capacity, their output. Used to be that Saudi Arabia had reserve output capacity and could fiddle with how much it put out. Now, it's not there because there's a slowing in the growth of energy supplies, and this comes at the same time that there's this accelerating world demand. What does that mean? Price goes up. There's also rising political instability that's provoked by this geopolitical competition, and when you have these arising industrial, the rising industrial capacity of nations like China, I mean, this is going to get crazy. So it seems to me that it would make some real sense to take George Bush seriously for once. I mean, I know it's hard, and I don't think he meant it seriously, about end our addiction to oil, to go on this crash program. And some people have said that we can't even do it, our industrial system, our transportation system, all of that put together, cannot operate on alternative fuels. But what about this? What about you can't build any new houses unless it has huge solar panels on it? I mean, what about a crash program of conservation? What about raising the required miles per gallon that our vehicles, all vehicles, get to, like 30, 40, 50 miles a gallon? I know, gee, it's not going to be very much fun. Can't have a real big car that goes real fast. But it's a little better than having your economy collapse, isn't it? That's what I'd say. All right, your calls, please. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werbe. If you'd like to see my website, it's peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. And you can email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Did I say the phone number? 313-298-WRIF. And here's Richard. Richard's calling from Farmington. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Peter. A long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed your show for a long time. You mentioned Common Dreams a few moments ago, the website Common Dreams. And they posted a piece by Bill Moyers on Friday.
Oh, yeah.
Which is still, I don't know if you read it or not, but I couldn't recommend it more highly. It's really lengthy, but it really lays out what's going on with respect to our government being bought out by and run by corporations right now. And as I say, I'd recommend it to everyone.
Okay.
I wanted to comment on this South Dakota situation.
Sure.
The legislature passing the abortion ban, and the governor saying he's going to sign it. This is just another example of putting the lie to a right-wing talking point all during the last two Supreme Court nomination proceedings. They kept saying everybody from Bush on down on that side. You know, we don't want judicial activists.
Right.
We want people who are going to interpret the law. Well, the point, that's exactly the opposite of what they want. They want people to get in there and change the law. Roe versus Wade is settled case law. That's how we do law in the United States. And now that they get Roberts and Alito in there, they think the balance has changed in the court. And that's exactly what they want, is judicial activists, in this case, to overturn the abortion. And I just think it shows them up again and as always to be the liars that they are.
Yeah, I thought you were going to be nice and call them hypocrites, but liars, I think, is a lot more accurate.
I think we should use the term liar a lot more than we do, because that's exactly what they are, and it's certainly a term that people understand.
You know, Richard, it actually has started to appear in the mainstream media before they would say, you know, kind of worse, maybe stretch the truth, or I can't remember all the euphemisms, but a number of columnists and even editorials have now just been using the word, the liar. Thank you, Richard.
Sure.
Call us again.
Thanks.
All right. Good night, and have a good one. Let's see. Making our show international, here's Jeff in Windsor. Jeff, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, great to talk to you. Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm actually an American living in Windsor since I was a child, but just had to comment about a previous caller who was wondering what can people do, and you mentioned about the protest and all that. I find that it's frightening this day and age that there's not a more direct, peaceful political mechanism that American people can do, as the caller said, to get Bush out of office. I mean, while we're protesting and having meetings, you know, American young women and men and Iraqi children are dying.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, after all this, all the lies that have been told, and basically North America cramming, or the Bush administration cramming our model of democracy down their throats, the Middle Eastern's throats. Where are all the great minds and the theologians of the world as far as coming up with a more realistic model of democracy and or religion? I mean, we're talking about a region that is thousands of years old in tradition, religion, and here comes the Bush administration saying, you must have this. And it's sad that in this day and age, with the great minds and the information, the history that we know about, we basically went in there like very Bush League.
Yeah, well, more like the Crusaders of 800 years ago, with the same sort of arrogance and in a lot of ways the same politics of the decision, making these decisions based on military force. And it didn't work then. 800 years ago, the West just wound up slaughtering people in the Middle East, and now this is occurring again.
Right.
So do we learn anything from history? Unfortunately, it doesn't look like a lot. All right, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your call. Let's take another call about demonstrations. It's John from Allen Park. Hey, John, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hi.
John from Allen Park.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. It seemed like one of the things that really helped during the Vietnam War was music.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing I don't hear anymore, I don't hear any political music against the war in Iraq or against Bush. I really think that was, that kind of like brought everybody together.
Well, there is, and there are some popular songs. I'm thinking Green Day and System of a Down and...
But I mean, all the concerts, I'm like Woodstock and all the peace movements that were going on at the time.
Well, it was a larger phenomenon then. And
I mean, even music during, like, the 60s with, like, Motown and all the rhythm and blues music, it kind of helped the mainstream white America come to grips with African-American music, and it kind of brought people together in that same way.
It did.
Music always seems to be the medium.
Well, I'll tell you, we're scattered now. We've been scattered to the winds. That idea that we were all like Woodstock Nation, or that we all wanted to solve America's problems of race and of war and of discrimination, that there was this ebullience that people thought we were moving into, what do they say then, the age of Aquarius, and now there's not the confidence. A lot of people that are involved, in fact, I often maybe even think the majority of people aren't pragmatists. That is to say, they're involved in the peace movement or they're involved in other aspects of social justice because they feel it's the ethical thing to do, which I think is wonderful. But even among them, they don't have this sense of we're going to be successful. They have to do it because it's an ethical imperative. But so that's missing, the idea that we can fight City Hall, that we can triumph over entrenched power and wealth. And we can, but we've got to reinstill that belief in us.
It seems like a lack of sacrifice. I don't know if that's the correct terminology, but it seems like more people are waiting for somebody else to do it.
Well, I'll tell you, John, I never understood that. Besides it being all of this work that I do, besides this broadcast, this political work that I do, I find it's the best and most interesting way to live. For instance, there's going to be a demonstration, huge demonstration, probably a million people, on April 29th to oppose Bush's war in Iraq. And my wife and I are going. And this is going to be an opportunity, for instance, the main thrust of it, the main reason we're going is to express our horror and our disgust at what Bush has done to our country and to their country. But at the same time, we're going to be there. I mean, if you've never been in an enormous demonstration, it's hard to really, to describe the feeling. But also, not just being part of this huge mass, which is, I think it's great, but also we're going to see all these people we know, people that are coming with us from Detroit, friends of ours in New York, friends of ours and some of my family that's coming in from other cities. So it's a way, that's what I was saying earlier, of reestablishing community. the powers that be, the elite, the ruling class, depends on two things. One is their incredible organization of everything from military and police power to control of information. And the other thing they depend on us is being these isolated, fragmented individuals that can never come together because, of A, if we start figuring things out, and B, if we figure out how to exercise power in a collective way, they know they're screwed. So, end of that. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see. All right. Where are we in all this? Okay. Here's Nancy in Manchester. Nancy, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How are you? Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm just calling because I have a car. I have an Explorer 2004, and it says I can use alternative gas. Now, I've only seen it maybe one place and nearby where I work.
Wait a minute. What's alternative gas? You mean like ethanol or something?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It says, so it's fairly new, and my husband just bought a used car, 2000. That's the same thing, but we don't do it. I don't know why not. I mean, maybe we will now that we're aware of where it's at.
Yeah.
But it's just shocking to me that in this era, that with all the technology we have, with all the different, you know, drugs we have to cure cancer and heart, you know, problems and all these amazing things, the internet, we can't come up with something different. Now, maybe if Bush is gone, that would help. But.
Yeah. Well, remember, he talked about getting off of oil. I'm trying to look for this. But he cut back on all the research being done for alternative fuels.
Mm-hmm.
Because, actually, he's like a dope pusher that says, oh, people shouldn't use heroin. At the same time, he knows that we don't have any choice, that like any addict, we don't have any choice. It's not, you know, our cities are laid out, so we need our cars, and we don't have any options to. So
right.
Yeah. So what we have to do is rather than wasting this like $500 billion a year on war and preparation for wars that we'll probably never fight, it's just a way of transferring our wealth. In other words, our taxes. You know, when you work and a third of it goes, and this enormous amount of it goes to build this huge military machine. Who, to fight guys that are planting roadside bombs? You don't need those kind of systems for that. So we could cut our military budget probably by 80%. We would still have the largest military and the largest military expenditures in the world, even if we cut it by 80%. And we could take all of that money that would work for us, not just these big defense contractors and not just Bush's buddies, but all of ours, communities.
So I'm not wrong in knowing, because my husband's a huge Republican, and we're always arguing about, not arguing, but discussing these issues. And one of the big things is he denies that it's about oil and things aren't changing. Because obviously, am I right? He's got so much money in oil, the president, that that's a huge.
Yeah, it's not just pure greed. I mean, it's not like Bush is trying to enrich or he and his friends directly, although that certainly happens. We know, we see that ExxonMobil and Chevron and all those companies have these record profits, and so it's obviously they're gouging us, and so they are making money. But it's mostly what they want is this strategic control of oil reserves, because they see what's happening in the future. They see that you have these emerging economies in Asia, and there's going to be competition for oil. And so what we want to be, they want to be positioned physically and politically on top of all of this. And some people might, there are some Republicans that say, hey, that's a good idea. I mean, somebody's going to control this, and it's either going to be them or us. Well, I would say as long as we are going to continue with a them and us mentality, there's nothing ahead of us other than disaster.
So, right. Seems smarter to me to come up with a new solution.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, there's an old expression. I think it was maybe H.L. Mencken or one of these commentators from the 1920s said, when they say it's not about the money, it's about the money. Same thing. When they say it's not about the oil, it's about the oil.
Yeah, I work in a hospital. I know all about that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nancy. Thanks for calling in from Manchester, Michigan. If you're listening around the world, that was not from Manchester, England. Here's Dave in Detroit. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You are on the air, sir. Go ahead.
It's David.
David, sorry, we had you down as Dave.
Well, Dave.
Yeah, okay. Some people, I'm good. Some people don't like to be called Dave.
Well, I do.
I know. Some people don't like to be called David. Particularly me. I hate when people call me David.
Dave, David, you know. Anyway, I think, you know, as far as we're talking about is a completely different focus, right?
Yeah, what's that?
Well, a focus on ecology.
Yeah, that's a kind of a good idea, I think.
And, like, alternative energy, solar power. You know, we have these trains that have no drag.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Well, I think it's something that we have to have great concern with. I was just looking at two things. I was right at the beginning of the show. I was saying that we may only be looking at the edge of the disaster, because the ultimate disaster may be, in the old phrase, nature bats last. And with the burning of fossil fuels, here, this is from the Sunday Times of England, a conservative paper. Acid seas kill off coral reefs. Could be that within a few decades, the coral reefs, along with hundreds of species of plankton and shellfish, could disappear. When CO2 produced by burning fossil fuels dissolves in the ocean, it forms carbonic acid. A little of this can benefit marine life. However, the huge volumes of carbon dioxide being released by humans are dissolving into the ocean so fast that sea creatures can no longer absorb it. Consequently, the levels of carbonic acid are rising and the oceans are turning sour. The oceans, the seemingly limitless space. Mother Jones, which is another publication I would highly recommend. Turn off your television. Read. We haven't talked about that in a while. Hey, Dave, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call, by the way. Television is, I mean, it's interesting to watch because you get to see visuals. But if you want information, it's virtually worthless when you compare it to what you can read. And I never watch television. I mean, I'll watch, my wife had me watching the finals of Dancing with the Stars, who won, Cheryl and Drew, right? I wanted P. Daddy to win, but whatever. But I, whether you agree or disagree with me, I mean, here's the proof. I hope I seem, at least I have a body of knowledge and information behind what I'm saying. You may think I'm totally wrong, but at least there's substance here. I'm not saying, what did that guy write? Liberal socialist moron. Or if I could say, what, right-wing fascist moron. I mean, I got more substance to that. None of this comes from watching television. In fact, for these broadcasts and these interviews and these shows that I do, including national ones, if I thought that I could learn a lot from watching television, I'd watch television all the time. This is my job. I'm supposed to know this stuff. But it's worthless. And I know that's a broad statement, and I'm not saying there's nothing you can ever learn. But all the time you spend watching CNN and Fox News and MSNBC and all that, it's a waste of time. It's hard on your eyes, and you got to watch all this junk and lies. Anyways, Mother Jones, motherjones.com. Their lead article is, apocalyptically, Last Days of the Ocean. We're pushing our seas to the brink. Can they be saved? This is some pretty dicey stuff. I mean, maybe call me in 5 years, 10 years, hopefully in 20 years, and you can say, well, Pete, you were really chicken little. The sky never fell. But things are looking worse and worse and worse. And until this is approached as a crisis, we're forestalling what could be a bigger catastrophe. In other words, if we started preparing now, because look, let's say that everything that the environmentalists, including myself, ecologists, all say about the potential for ecological disaster is true. So we decide we're going to have to start right now and preparing to head that off. So we do all this conservation, we get off of oil, we, you know, whatever, a million things that you know that environmentalists say. What's the downside of it? If we were off oil, we wouldn't be in the Middle East. We wouldn't be transporting this toxic substance that spills and burns and fouls the atmosphere and all that. All right? So let's say, okay, you're like, there's one of the big right-wing talk guys says, this is just liberal stuff in order to take your SUV away. All right? So we say, okay, I don't see it yet. I just took a deep breath. Nothing's wrong. Science will fix this. Well, then we come to it, and all of a sudden, it's this huge unsolvable problem. Wasn't it something like Occam's razor? Isn't that what it's called? You err on the side of judiciousness? I mean, and again, what's the downside of going the route of ecologists? All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Chris. Chris is in East Point. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing today, Peter?
Doing good.
You know, I love this country. There's no other greater place in the world to live than here, but I'll tell you what. We've got a big, big problem, and his name is George W. Bush.
Yeah.
And that whole administration. Where has our country gone? I mean, when we had Clinton in office, he's the only president next to, I think, one or two other ones to balance the budget. He comes in less than 5 years and gives us a budget deficit that I think this country has never seen in all its 200 and something years of existence.
I think it is the biggest, particularly, you know, in certainly in absolute terms. I wonder percentage-wise, but whatever. I thought conservatives always wanted to balance the budget.
You know, I'm so sick and tired of these right-wings babbling. Like, look at Bush in the 2004 presidential election. All he ranted and raved about was how he hated gays and how he hated gay marriages. Now look at him. You never hear about him again. He never talks about it. He figures, oh, well, I won. Oh, well, you know?
Yeah. Well, go ahead. I was going to say that one of the ways that they're trying to balance the budget, since all of this is, since they gave away tax breaks to the ultra-wealthy, since it's all going down the rat hole of war, that they're going to cut off poor people from food stamps and from all these other, disabled seniors are going to have their benefits cut. Their Medicaid, Medicare premiums are going to go up for the poor. I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, yeah, and you know, another thing that amazes me is, you know, now all of a sudden you hear all these people talking about how the U.S. has all this oil, and, you know, I've heard even something like that, we have more oil in the U.S., than in the Middle East, but we don't tap it. Why don't we start drilling it now and start conserving it? Because like you said, it's going to run out eventually over there. That's part of the reason why they're so pissed off at us in the Middle East is because we take all the Middle Eastern oil. And we're trying to go over there and tell these people how to live and control it. Why don't we start drilling ours now and using ours? And I guarantee you'll find that they'll be a lot less pissed off at us.
Yeah, if we get to get out of there. But I'll tell you, Chris, our oil reserves have reached peak a long time ago. There's not a lot there for us to get. That's why they're talking about trying to wring a little bit out of these pristine natural areas up in Alaska. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Yeah, here, since 2000, almost 3 million families have faced foreclosure. During that time, home foreclosures increased by more than 50%. This is all on Bush's watch, right? One in five mortgages is considered to be subprime, and these loans are three times more likely to be susceptible to foreclosure. Da-da-da-da-da-da. More than 60% of American families live paycheck to paycheck, escalating their risk of financial crisis and foreclosure. Oh. All right, let's take another call. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, here's Linda from Windsor. Linda, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing good. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, it's the first time I ever called. I love your show. It's really good.
Oh, thank you.
I've learned so much from you.
Really? Good.
Yeah. Okay, I have a question. I don't understand, like, over here, if we have, Prime Minister was like, we had an early election, can't you do that to get Bush out? Like, you guys throw an early election? You can't do that, or?
No. That's the deal.
Oh.
I mean, the idea was to create some stability so that you wouldn't have, like, a situation for so many years in Italy where you had governments every other day, or you wouldn't have a situation like you folks have where you have an election and then you have somebody who is a minority government, right? Harper.
Yeah, because we just threw, like, we had an early election for, because of, Paul Martin.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I forget, was health stuff and a lot of mistakes. And then, like, I'm hearing you guys, like, I feel bad for you guys. You got all those problems. And I think, why couldn't they throw an early election? Like, you know, that would be good.
Well, it would, but I certainly don't think. It doesn't work the same. And the other thing is, the government has to call it, and there's no way that Bush would call an election right now, because they would lose so badly. The whole Republican Party would probably wind up getting like 25% of the vote or something.
Yeah. Well, how did they throw Nixon out? Because I remember watching him get on the plane when I think I was like 14.
How sweet that was. Yeah, Nixon was the process of impeachment, where he was going to be charged with high crimes and misdemeanors, and then he resigned because he knew he was out of there.
It was either that or they were going to fire him, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, well, can't they do that with Bush? Because he's done so many, like, not being there fast enough, like for 9/11 and all those other things, like Katrina and...
Well, there has to be, there have to be the votes. And right now, there's no way in the world that the Republican majority in both houses of Congress would even initiate a process. Now, what the Republicans are worried about would be that if the Democrats won in 2006 and the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers of Detroit, would be the head of it because of his seniority, and he was the same man that began, who introduced the bill of impeachment for Richard Nixon so long ago.
Oh.
All right, thanks again. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Yeah, there's some oddities to this system, isn't there? Like the Electoral College. Wow. So you have a loser. Nobody disputes that George W. Bush got the less votes than Al Gore in 2000 and wound up heading this country. Whew. All right, we'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Think you have what it takes to be the next Riff Rock Girl? 101 WRIF and the Tri-County Pontiac GMC dealers, along with MGM Grand Detroit Casino, are looking for one very special woman to be the 2006 Riff Rock Girl. Think you can handle a $30,000 year-long contract? How about your choice of a new Pontiac or GMC? A Riff ad, Inside Stuff magazine? Oh, yeah. And you'll be a star in a Riff TV commercial. Go ahead and mark it in your day planner now. The first casting call to find the Riff Rock Girl will be at March 4th between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. at GameWorks inside Great Lakes Crossing in Auburn Hills. If you're 21 or older, bring your bio and a photo of yourself to one of the RIF's three auditions. For more details and official rules, visit WRIF.com. Are you the next Riff Rock Girl? The 2006 Riff Rock Girl Search. Presented by Tri-County Pontiac GMC Dealers. Also brought to you in part by MGM Grand Detroit Casino, where the city shines. And 101 WRIF. Everything.
Rocks. This is WRIF.com.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. This is our final segment, and at 1 a.m. I'll be airing a couple of interviews, one with an author who's just written a book about the old Negro baseball leagues, and including one from Detroit, team from Detroit, Detroit Stars. Extraordinarily interesting interview. And also Patricia Campbell, Vice President of the Irish Independent Workers Union. We'll be talking with her. Mark in Chesterfield writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. There's no way the Democrats would do anything different with Iraq. All politicians are woven with the same thread. Their podiums look different, but the message is the same. There's a lot of truth in that. And yet, I think if we moved them, at least they're responsive in a manner that I think the Republicans wouldn't be. I mean, they're barely anything to write home about. I mean, where are they now in all this? I mean, why aren't they up there leading the resistance? Yeah, I know. All right. Here's Jim in Ann Arbor. Jim, hi. It's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hello. I was wondering if you think we have an education crisis in this country.
Well, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. Because I think people, like, they try to, you know, go after what Hollywood says. And like you said, you know, what the popularity, what the popular, you know, thing is going on at the time, you know.
Well, I think, Jim, a lot of the education crisis has to do with funding. So when you take our tax monies out of the richest country in the world, and rather than utilizing them for this educational system, rather than all of that, it gets used for war. And what do they spend, like $2 billion a year on advertising to get young people into the military? Well, you're not going to wind up with a superior school system. I mean, that's a good part of it. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Jeremy. Jeremy's in Westland. Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for joining me. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing tonight?
Doing good. Thanks for calling.
Just want to make a couple comments and then, you know, listen to, you know, your response or your thoughts on them. You know, we're talking about pretty much the whole geopolitical situation that the world's in. The one thing I have a problem with, I got a bachelor's in political science and finish up a master's in economics, and I've noticed that working on the economics part of it, the driving factor in the education I'm getting is, you know, the economy is here to serve the purpose of all these insatiable wants and desires, and it's based on this mass consumption. And you touched earlier on, you know, just the pretty much a crash diet of oil.
Uh-huh.
I think that can be achieved if, being that, you know, Americans are the largest consumers in the world, would learn to consume less. Maybe not as far as transportation goes, but, you know, Walmart didn't get to be the largest corporation in the world by us consuming less. They sell a bunch of crap cheap, and we love it. It's not that, well, hey, I only need one TV, but it's that Walmart has, you know, a TV for $50, so I might as well buy 50 of them.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem. And some other things to throw out there that other callers have touched on.
Well, wait a minute, Jeremy. Let me just talk about consumption. The idea of reducing waste and pollution and all the negative sides of production and consumption, to reduce the lead end of it, the production and the consumption, is to threaten the whole economy. And that's one of the things that's wrong with this economy. It demands to always be on this red-hot track where we have to be expanding our consumption, because production, in order to create profit, has to be always expanded. So it's a real problem.
Yeah, and that goes with, I mean, that's the profit motive of the firm. I mean, you learn that from day one. What's the number one goal of the firm that is producing, say, a widget? They love to throw that out there. And they always say the number one goal is to maximize profit. So $500 million isn't good enough. You need a billion. A billion isn't good enough. I need five. $5 billion, I need to make 10. And so I agree with you. It's a vicious cycle, and until it changes. But I say if you go back 50 years ago, when this country was a major exporter, not an importer, we actually built something. And I think that's why China has gotten to where it is today, because they actually built stuff and then they export it. And if you look 50 years ago, most of the industries in this country were heavily unionized. There wasn't this issue of moral indecency that Republicans love to harp on. Your local union hall was what it was, a local union hall where families would meet, family gatherings, block parties, and all that other good stuff. And the family unit is what mattered, not mass consumption and having, you know, all of your wants and desires fulfilled, but just, you know, what you needed.
Well, yeah, things have changed, though. What were once items of desire become necessities. You know, Jeremy, I'm going to leave it at that because I want to get everybody in before the end of the hour. So thanks for your comments. I agree with a lot of what you say. Appreciate it. And here's Bill in Southfield. Bill, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Hello. Peter, I wanted to ask you about something. I was watching one of the news channels, I think it was about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. Ted Nugent, they were interviewing him, and he was just wanted to know how you felt. He was talking about running for the governor of Michigan, and then he was praising some of the right-wingers like John Engler, who, you know, run the deficit state of Michigan over $1 billion. He was praising George Bush, who run the national deficit up over $7.2 trillion. And I was just wanted to listen to your comments, what you felt.
Well, wait a minute. I thought, well, Nugent, he's an idiot.
Yeah.
He's a great guitar player and ought to stick with that. But he, everything else, just motor mouth. Hey, I thought that Nugent had moved to Crawford, Texas to be near his idol, George Bush.
Well, yeah, he did, but he was talking about running for governor of the state of Michigan, and he had all this praise for these people who, you know, run up these massive deficits.
Yeah.
I mean, how could he do that?
I don't know. What does he look like? Does he still look like Mountain Man?
Yeah, he looks like the Mountain Man. He was going on about, you know, what a great guy Engler was.
Oh, man.
What a great guy, you know, Bush was, and all these conservatives who run up the deficits.
I don't know. How can you be a rock and roll idol and be some right-wing conservative? It just doesn't make a bit of sense. It's so against the spirit of rock and roll. That's why 90-95% of all rock stars are liberal and left. You know, it's just, it goes with the music, it goes with the culture, it goes with what produced it. And maybe just because these guys got to be millionaires, maybe that was it. Maybe that's what turned their head around. I don't know. All right, Bill, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. Here is Shane in Toledo. Shane, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter? I just wanted to mention, like, an alternate fuel. They were talking, one of your callers earlier on, about ethanol,
E85.
And I was just wondering, I'm pretty positive it's made by a product of corn.
Right.
And what I was wondering was, if that's the case, wouldn't it help our economy out huge if they actually use that more efficiently? We'd be less dependent on other countries and use corn as an alternate thing than just eating it.
Yeah, well, I'm not 100% sure about what I'm going to say, but I think the majority of corn raised in the United States is fed to cattle and other livestock.
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned one day that how fatty and how bad corn actually is for the human body.
No, corn? Oh, no. Corn's great.
Well, but the like corn oil and all those other products you're making by it, it'd be a lot better if you're using it for a fuel source so you're not spending all your money overseas.
Yeah, well, absolutely, because when we talk about, I mean, we're mad now because gas going back up, it's like $2.36 a gallon and all that. I think I mentioned last week that doesn't even begin to take into account the amount of money, and that's what you're indicating, that is spent in order to ensure the continuing flow of oil. So we have given, who knows, if you start adding up the billions that we've given to countries in the Middle East, everybody from Saudi Arabia to Israel to Egypt and Jordan and the United Arab Emirates and all these other people, that to ensure that we continue to have oil pumped here. I mean, the cost of gas could be real cost of gas could be $10 a gallon or something like that. All right, thanks a lot, Shane. I appreciate it. And maybe some of you probably know this. Ethanol, is it made from anything else other than corn? Usually you think of corn. A lot of this stuff, what they call biomass, anything from hemp, A lot of you hempsters. I haven't heard from any hempsters in a while. Have all the hempsters gone away? That you can make fuel from hemp oil. Wasn't Willie Nelson, actually Willie Nelson has a product called Bio Willie. I don't know why. It sounds like a porn movie or something like that, but I don't know why. Anyways, he has, and he at least has a car, maybe even has his tour bus or whatever. So he's way into alternative fuels. But you can make fuel oil enough to power cars from any biomass. In other words, so what does that mean? Can you do it from wheat, grass? Some of you guys know that. Tell me. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Fred from Mount Clemens. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Yeah, hey, I just appreciate people like you and John Stossel, and as far as hemp goes,
yeah,
for sure.
I'm talking about for fuel oil, though.
What's that?
I'm talking about for fuel oil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Biomass.
Biomass, yeah.
And what I'm thinking is...
Wait a minute. What was this...
What?
Never mind. Go ahead.
What I'm thinking of is, why can't we get some kind of national project to get a train that runs on, I forget what you call it, but it's a train that runs on magnets.
Yeah, I forgot what it's called, too. But thanks, man. All right, we're going to move on. Let's see. Here's our next caller. Craig from Monroe. Craig, hi, you're on the air.
Well, hey, Peter, where are we?
Hi.
There's lots of rumors going around that Hillary Clinton's going to run next time around. What is your knowledge of this, and how do you feel about that?
Well, I don't know any more than what I read. Common sense of things is that she is going to run. I just saw that Karl Rove, the dark force behind Bush, if it's possible to be a dark force behind a dark force, it's Karl Rove, the Republican strategist, and he said that Hillary will win the primaries and become the Democratic candidate for president in 2008, and he predicted she will lose. Well, it's kind of hard, given that everything seems so insane and everything is thrown up in the air, to get any sense of how the political situation is going to be. Right now, you could run almost anyone as a Democrat and would beat any Republican if the election was, say, held tomorrow. Hillary doesn't offer much of a alteration from things as they are, and anything will be better than Bush. And she certainly, a great number of her votes are not much to write home about. What do you think?
It just seems like that would be a lose situation for the Democrats. I just can't see them doing that. You know, I don't know if America's ready for a woman president right now.
I don't know. Some people have said it's going to be a choice between Hillary and Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah.
That's what I say, too. Damn, we can do better than that, can't we? All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Let's see. Here's Jamie calling in from Ontario. Where are you calling in from in Ontario?
I'm just trucking along the 401 up here.
Okay.
First time, long time.
Okay. Welcome.
Anyways, I got to ask you, why... Do you not think that the big three should step in here? Like, I mean, we have the Japanese market that pretty much dominates the hybrid. Why do you think that GM, Ford, or Chrysler has not stepped in there and gotten into this game a little quicker than they have? I mean, they've got the brains and the money to do it. I mean, they generate billions of dollars every year. Why can't they get in there and get in on this game?
I don't know, Jamie. Don't they seem to have, like, about a 30- or 40-year history of making bad decisions?
Well, apparently, although we do have a voracious appetite for horsepower, but I mean...
Yeah, yeah.
I just can't seem to figure out why these guys are out there spending billions of dollars coming up with new concept cars. Like, you take a look at this Cadillac that they want to come out with, a 12-cylinder, just a gas guzzler, you know? Like, I'm in the automotive industry, and, like, I've been driving truck for over 10 years now. They've got a biodiesel that they're trying to push now, and I've seen the trucks up and down the highways here in Ontario. So far, from what I've heard on them, they're generating more miles per gallon than just your typical diesel. I mean, you're getting almost twice the mileage per gallon. And if they can get that out of a biodiesel, and, you know, with the ethanol and everything else, too, that was another good point that was brought up. The ethanol is a corn-based product, and, I mean, we can grow it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And with the amount of land that we have, the potential is unlimited. It's just a matter of convincing the consumers that it is a better product to be purchased.
Well, I'll tell you, Jamie, I think a lot of it is that cultures, societies, economies, sometimes you got it and sometimes you don't. And we may be in that downward slope. I mean, I hope that's not the case, but in terms of political leadership and the alternatives and the way things are going, it looks like we're on the downside of things. So where do we find the people that for North America that can start you know, having a vision? I mean, what vision do we get out of this current crop of rulers? Not much. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see here. An unsigned email says, Ted Nugent moved to Texas after his home was demolished due to severe mold. Oh, yeah, I remember that. His family was sick for months. Well, yeah, I mean, that would happen to me. If my house had to be torn down because of mold, I would move to Crawford, Texas. I mean, it only makes sense. I mean, this is a guy that, you know, can't fault him for that, right? Here's Brett in Ferndale. Brett, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing great. Thanks for calling.
That's good. I just want to make a comment to actually both those guys that called about the biodiesel and the ethanol made by corn. With the growth of the economy and the housing industry going the way it's going, this land doesn't have, we don't have enough land to produce enough product to sustain the fuel we need.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, the biodiesel, I run a truck coast to coast. I run 48 states. And, you know, the biodiesel is a great way to go. I agree 100% with that stuff. But we just don't have the land to produce enough soybean and enough corn to sustain what our culture is using in fuel.
You mean, in other words, if we tried to go completely over to biomass-based diesel, there just is not enough space for corn and soybeans to produce
exactly.
It. Well, you know, some people have said that we are in a situation where, on one hand, all the problems that are attendant to oil, from war to pollution and scarcity, and on the other hand, that we do not have, as you said, the capacity to replace that all with alternatives. But one of the things people usually talk about, like some different alternate fuels. But when I used to broadcast into northern New Mexico, there was one of the sponsors of the local show there that carried my program. He built subdivisions, and that every house in the subdivision had these enormous solar panels enough. And I know that's New Mexico. I know it's northern New Mexico. It's not gray Detroit or Ferndale. But that's the kind of thing that could be mandated. Because, I don't know, what would a system like that cost? Another 10 grand, maybe, on it, or 15 grand at the most? But say 10 grand. I mean, you're talking about houses that are $250,000 now to make so they're 260. And ultimately, that would work for the homeowner, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, my dad, you know, back 10 years ago, went with an alternate solar panel as a secondary warmth system for the house during the daylight hours.
Wait, I mean,
it worked fine, but like you said, up here, it's so gray, especially during, you know, the fall and the winter months, you know, that we just don't have the sunlight to sustain that. Now, if they could come up with some sort of rechargeable system that would retain the battery power, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Then that would be a great alternate source of electricity or something along those lines. But as far as for heating or cooling or anything like that, it wouldn't sustain because we don't have enough sunlight here.
Yeah, no, and that's what takes a lot of the energy. All right, let's see, Brett. I got to move on because just got a few minutes left. Thank you for your comments. Appreciate that. Here's Jason in Grosse Pointe. Jason, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Earlier, you asked if there were additional sources of biological fuels.
Uh
And Bush, in his State of the Union, pulled out of his hat this idea of switchgrass being used. Now, granted, he got the idea from somebody who was a like heavily involved with the researchers in the field about a week before his speech, so it's not like he actually knows what he's talking about. But switchgrass apparently is potentially viable, at least as a partial supply for biological fuels. The comment I wanted to make is that if you look at Europe as a model for how to go with alternative fuel planning, they've got an increasing rate of wind production facilities that are being created every year. France is definitely the leader in that. And if you take a look at the stats, I don't have them offhand, but if you take a look at the stats, France and the majority of Western Europe are leading the pack in alternative energy sources as far as actually implementing it in their society. They make California look like, you know, it's an old West Republican district that isn't even trying.
Yeah, they have these huge wind fields with these numerous big windmills,
yeah, and
wind towers.
For the last few decades, the vehicles that have been driven in Europe have a much better gas mileage than those in America, and gas prices in Europe have been higher. And I think that what you're going to see over time is pure and simple capitalism, even though it's got its downsides, as earlier callers have pointed out, will force the price of oil higher than it already is. And when it gets to be at an intolerable level and the market and the buyers who use it every day can no longer sustain their businesses.
Well, that's a market model of change, and that's the best-case scenario. The worst-case scenario, of course, is we're partially involved in now, war for oil, and who knows what's going to happen down the line from all of this. I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Here's Jason in Redford. Jason, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great.
What people don't understand is hemp plants, marijuana plants, produce three times as much ethanol as corn would.
Cool. So,
and on top of that, paper uses like less than a fourth of the chemicals to produce paper, you know, and they're just too afraid of, ooh, pot plants growing in a field, kids are going to run through it.
Yeah, no, that's bumweed. I mean, that's what's so weird about it. I mean, to get smokable, high, you know, THC-laden plant, you gotta do different things to it. The commercial grade hemp, probably the best you can get on it is a slight buzz and a big headache. Yeah, I think all hemsters know that. So yeah, you're right. Those people shouldn't worry. Well, so much to talk about. We're damn out of time. My apologies. I'm looking at what all of Mike and Dave and Larry and Frank. I see what you want to talk about, and I'd like to get you all on the air, but can't do it. Call back next week. Stay tuned for the interviews. I think you'll like them.
This is WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Usually, to get ready for an interview, I do what? Read the book, do a little Googling, find out about the author, find out a little more about the subject. This one was a lot easier for me. All I had to do was get my Detroit Stars baseball cap and put it on and get ready to do this one. And if you're scratching your head and thinking, Detroit Stars, is he talking about rock stars, movie stars? No, I'm talking about a baseball team. And certainly my guest will know about the Detroit Stars and probably tell us a lot about them. My guest is Lawrence D. Hogan. He is the author, one of the authors, the principal author of Shades of Glory, The Negro Leagues and the Story of African American Baseball. And Lawrence Hogan is a senior professor of history at Union County College in Cranford, New Jersey, and he's presently serving as director of Out of the Shadows. It's a study of the history of African Americans in baseball, and it's sponsored by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and the Office of the Commissioner of Major League Baseball. Lawrence Hogan, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Very nice to be with you, Peter. Thank you for your interest.
It's hard to broadcast with this hat on, but I think I'm going to take it off.
Well, it's a very appropriate thing to be wearing if you're in Detroit and know anything at all about the history of black baseball.
Well, I certainly am learning a lot more by looking at your book, Shades of Glory. I think of all the information here, and we'll let you tell a little of the story, I think what almost struck me the most was this is being sponsored by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and the Office of the Commissioner of Major League Baseball. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, the project out of which Shades of Glory is a product started 4 years ago with a major grant that the Hall of Fame secured from Major League Baseball to try to do a complete and definitive study of blacks in baseball, not just the Negro Leagues, but well before the Negro Leagues as well. And two of my colleagues, co-directors, Larry Lester and Dick Clark, incidentally, Dick Clark is the biggest Detroit Stars fan in the world. He lives in Ypsilanti. Dick and Larry put together a statistical overview of the subject, unlike anything that's been done up to now. And that hasn't been published yet, but we're relying heavily on it for the vote that we're going to do this weekend for the Hall of Fame. And my side of it was to do a narrative history, and I think we've done a good job of that. I put together a team of authors, and we take the story from slavery times all the way down to the demise of the Negro Leagues in the 1950s.
Yeah, it's a fabulous book, 432 pages, 50 vintage photographs. It's published by National Geographic. Tell me, Lawrence Hogan, your particular personal interest. I mean, why, as an historian of all the possible little hidden pockets of history in America, why this one of the Negro baseball leagues?
Well, people frequently ask me that, and the baseball side of it is a matter of having, I think, as best I can remember, come out of my mother's womb with an interest in baseball. But the black side of it involves involvement with African American history for upwards of 30 years now. And my initial focused research into the black story is a book that came out in the late 80s and recently out again in a revised and updated version, Black National News Service, which was a history of the Associated Negro Press, a black version of AP and UPI, serving the great black papers of the 1920s and 30s and 40s. As a news gathering agency, I was writing an institutional history, but I couldn't stay away from the sports pages. And I found there black baseball in all its richness, and then came to the work of Bob Peterson, who we just lost a week ago, the Only the Ball Was White, and John Holway's early work, and the subject just captured me. It's mm-hmm. kept me captured ever since.
Well, I suspect, although maybe it's not even that great an understanding, that people have a view of baseball as being segregated, like most of American society, some dominated by Southern white ball players, some really vicious racists like Detroit's own Ty Cobb, and then Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier, and everything is okay since then. But The history is a lot deeper and richer, isn't it?
Oh, it's very much deeper and richer than the popular perception. And everything that you said is important to know and know about. But I think there's much more as well that people need to know. And I think Shades will give them that much more. The Negro Leagues, for most folks, if they do know about it, Satchel and Josh Gibson and sure. Satchel Paige. When Satchel went into the Hall of Fame in 1971, he said, there are many Satchels and many Joshes, and we hope that someday they'll get recognition they're due as well. And some of those Satchels and Joshes go all the way back to well before the turn into the 20th century.
I know that within the black community that there is the feeling that that one of the many reasons, other than just social convention, that blacks were kept out of the leagues is, whether this is true or myth or both, that that the black players were so good that they would have overshadowed the white players.
Well, the so good is certainly correct, but I don't think that's the explanation for keeping that so good where it was. Racism is so pervasive, and segregation is a part of American life as much as apple pie, motherhood, and the 4th of July, through so many decades after the failure of Reconstruction to live up to the promises of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And so baseball is reflective of so many other parts of our society where barriers had to be broken down and where, while they were present, blacks had to do for themselves with their own resources what the larger world was telling them they couldn't do.
Mm-hmm. Also, and this is why I found your book, Shades of Glory, so enlightening, I assume somehow that blacks found baseball like in the late teens or early 20s, but you stretch it way back even into slavery, don't you?
Yes, we do. Yeah, that was one of the things that fascinated me the most as our research unearthed the WPA interviews that were done in the 1930s with ex-slaves up in their 70s and 80s, and some instances their 90s, and recollecting having played the game back in the pre-Civil War South, the 1850s, possibly even into the 1840s, and the memories there that connect blacks. Well, I use a phrase in my teaching frequently, present at the creation. If you're present at the creation of something, that makes you significant. And baseball's really being created in those decades, and there is a black presence.
My guest is Lawrence D. Hogan. He's the principal author of Shades of Glory, The Negro Leagues and the Story of African-American Baseball. And you're listening to The Peter Werby Show. This covers, your book covers such a sweep of history, at least to the end of the 19th century, because it's not all segregated then, is there? That was surprising to me as well.
No, it isn't. There's a window, you might say, of openness to blacks playing, although within limits. Never was it completely open, but we have records of upwards of 30 blacks who played on what would have been integrated teams then, in the first in 1878 with Bud Fowler, and then through the decade of the 1880s, as professional baseball is beginning to be framed and established, even up to the majors. In one instance with Moses Fleetwood Walker in 1884. But all that begins to come to an end as Jim Crow becomes institutionalized. Anticipating Plessy versus Ferguson in 96, in the 1880s, the doors start to close on those blacks, and we have to then, we wait for Jackie.
Where did the segregation, the pressures for segregation, was it the players, was it the owners, was it the leagues, or all of them?
What's interesting, in the 1880s, it tends to be more the players than the owners, Southern players in this instance, and the owners bowing to prejudice in specific instances of their Southern contingent on their teams. I suppose not wanting to have to deal with that, it couldn't have happened without the connivance or the acquiescence of the owners, but a major part of the thrust does come from prejudiced players.
Mm-hmm. Bring us a little, if you would, into the 20th century when the Negro Leagues, so there were more than one? I also didn't know that.
Yes, and it takes two decades before a professional Negro League comes into being in 1920. Rube Foster, of course, the father of black baseball, professional baseball on that level, Chicago American Giants, but also the Detroit Stars. Foster has a direct connection to the Stars establishment here in Detroit, envisioning the coming of a league and the profits to be made from baseball at that point in time. It's Foster who establishes that team here, found some local support in some black entrepreneurs here in Detroit. And by 1920, the Stars are a part, of course, of the founding of the league. In 23, the Eastern Colored League comes into being, and so now we have something almost equivalent to the majors, an Eastern and Western Conference. And in 24, then the first Negro League World Series.
Hmm. And how big a draw was it within the black community?
Oh, big draw. Yeah, big draw. Intensely proud we're black residents of Chicago and of Detroit and of Philadelphia and of New York, of the teams that sprang up here. Well, they might be. It was excellent baseball, and they owned those teams in special ways. When society is telling you in so many negative ways that you can't be this and you can't be that, and you become that, you take great pride in it.
Mm-hmm. I remember my father telling me where the Detroit Stars played, and it's right out of my mind. It's, I think, over on Mack Avenue somewhere in Detroit.
I believe that's right. I recollect something of that sort myself.
So there was like a stadium over there, and then this.
Yeah, well, frequently the black teams had to rent stadiums from existing white clubs. In Chicago, that wasn't the case, at least through the 20s, the early 20s. They played at Shoreline Park and had a Chicago American Giants had basically control over that park. But in most other of the cities, they were dependent on other ownership, which made it difficult, you know, to schedule and to secure the profits that they would have liked to.
Mm-hmm. Within the constrictions of segregated society, there were a number of luminaries within black society. And did the athletes within the Negro Leagues, were they up in that pantheon of stars?
I certainly believe they were. Right from the inception of black baseball on a high professional level. I was thinking this morning about an incident that's in the book in 1924, I think it's the spring of 24, when Rube Foster and the Chicago American Giants are heading down to Texas for spring training. And I suspect it was probably into Arkansas, where they stopped in a small rural town. Foster apparently was coming in from Hot Springs to catch up with his team. And the fans welcomed them with open arms. It was black baseball's first great national team, this Chicago American Giants. And they were known there in that little town. Wonderful reception for them. And I think that was very much a part of the story as well. And so they were very much a part of their people's lives.
Lawrence Hogan, did our Detroit Stars ever win anything? I don't.
Oh, they played excellent baseball. They were in the upper ranges of the division. Divisional championships. I don't believe they ever won. No, they never appeared in the Negro League World Series. That basically stopped after 1927, not to be renewed until the 1940s when the Stars are no longer a part of the baseball structure, the black baseball structure. But if they did nothing else, and I know he played for other teams, but certainly he was a great Detroit black player. Normal Turkey Stearns, Baseball Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful player.
This is getting pretty much ahead of the story, but there's been this renewed interest within the African-American community of the Negro Leagues, and I know there's a museum in Kansas City. There's actually retail outlets in the Detroit area where you can get Negro League paraphernalia. So it's had this unexpected, I guess would be a better word.
Well, I think that's true, unexpected, and perhaps even odd and from some perspectives. Certainly, I came to this subject in a focused way back in the early 1980s, and you know, several people predate me to it. And I think when we get together, we shake our heads and say we never expected that we'd be where we are today.
Yeah,
and it has the popularity and the focus that it has in such as you say, memorabilia items and jerseys and whatnot.
Yeah, they even have friends of mine, when they've been like in Kansas City, they bring back like mouse pad from the National Negro League Museum. So there's a lot out there to remember it. We're talking about this wonderful book with its principal author, Lawrence D. Hogan. It's called Shades of Glory, The Negro Leagues and the Story of African-American Baseball. And the whole project's being sponsored by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and the Office of the Commissioner of Major League Baseball. So they're making a real commitment commitment. And there are things ahead with this, or is it this month, which where we're recording this in Negro history, well, now called Black history, or have we moved along to African American history?
Well, I think that's the term African American history. The African American is used most often, but I refer to it as Black history.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when you're using it historically, you appropriately say Negro history or Negro baseball, because that's the appropriate historical term, always capitalized. But yes, there are many things ahead to look forward to. The vote that we'll take this weekend in Tampa, a group of 12 of us who have been selected by the Hall of Fame, and off of a list of 39 eligible Negro Leaguer and pre-Negro League players and executives, I'm pinching myself. I have a vote to include someone in the Hall of Fame. And then the specialness of this summer in Cooperstown on July the 30th, whatever the number be that we elect from out of our group, they'll be honored in special ways at the induction ceremony. Hopefully someday the work of Dick Clark and Larry Lester, the statistical work, which will be available at the Hall for researchers, will find a publisher, because that's very important, too, to have that statistical record. And
yeah.
So lots of good things to look forward to.
And in the back of Shades of Glory, there is a lot of interesting statistics as well. So here we have this flourishing Negro Leagues. We have the all-white major leagues, and particularly in the 20s and 30s and the 40s, really in their heydays of both. Does the twain ever meet?
It does, yes, in postseason play. And sometimes people forget that even during the season, on occasion, when major league teams were traveling on an off day, they'd hook up against some local black club. But it was very extensive in postseason play, and we have lots of records that document the fact that black players more than held their own against white major leaguers in those games.
Well, how did there was such resentment in the when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. Why did these white players willingly take part in these?
The players themselves by those decades certainly were professional and more than willing to play against quality professionals, opponents, particularly if a payday was there, and it was a good payday. They attracted large crowds. So people, I think, expect that it shouldn't be there somehow, and yet because segregation was in place in so many places and firmly in place, that this didn't threaten that. It didn't seem to be a threat to it. It was not going to, deal a blow to the segregation that was there simply because these people squared off on a baseball diamond.
Now, one thing that surprised me in your book, Lawrence Hogan, Shades of Glory, was, well, I think I'm going to kind of back into it. Let me just start by saying, or by asking, when did the agitation for integration of the major leagues take place? I know the Negro Press, as it was called at that time, were often talking about that, and so was the Daily Worker, the newspaper of the American Communist Party.
That's correct.
Yeah, so when did this all begin? Was it in the 30s?
Well, I would say it began as soon as the barriers went up. If you want to date it from a specific moment within the ranks of black baseball, read Sol White's History of Baseball, 1906, the publication that so many of us rely on for the history of black baseball prior to the turn of the century. Sol White was a great black player who played integrated and then was squeezed off into black teams. And he makes a very strong case against this kind of thing happening. And all throughout the succeeding decades, the teens and the 20s and the 30s, if you're reading the black papers, which is the source for this history, you see that while they celebrated their own and took great joy in their own, they also beat the drum for integration.
So they were interested in playing integrated ball, because I was thinking there were these parallel, although certainly not equal, institutions, and the idea often, as expressed by some black nationalists, is why do we want to integrate with these people like the Ty Cobbs of the world that had such virulent racist feelings?
Well, I don't think that holding on to your own and celebrating your own and wanting integration were incompatible back then. Trying to put yourself back into the mindset of that period, you knew you were good, You knew you could play against them. You knew that's where the money was. And at the same time, you took great joy in your own institutions. And when, of course, integration comes, certainly much was lost. People were put out of work who should have been able to earn their living at baseball because they were very good, as integration, you know, opens up only slowly the doors to a select few. And the specialness of those Negro Leagues. So I understand the nationalist, you know, separatist kind of perspective here. But I don't think that in the context of the times, the people who lived that history felt at all incompatible in celebrating and at the same time pushing for integration.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were some far-seeing people within the Negro Leagues that saw integration bringing about the death of the black leagues.
Oh, I think that's very true. I think anyone who had any practical sense at all knew that the continued existence of would be endangered by, and the owners knew that. I don't know how much the players thought about it because they were enjoying the game so much playing it, but the writing was on the wall, as it was for so many other black institutions, behind what Dr. Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, calls the veil that separated white from black America. The black press, I mean, there's nothing like the black press in the 20s, 30s, and 40s in terms of ethnic people presses in this country. And, you know, into the 50s, when integration comes, as was the case with baseball, decline sets in.
Mm-hmm. Now, the story of Jackie Robinson, in fact, gee, there's so much here, and that's why I think that, Lawrence Hogan, you've written the book, Shades of Glory, because there's too much for a radio show. But Branch Rickey is often thought of as, or portrayed as, some very brave, having a commitment to civil rights, and yet I'd heard this story that he actually realized that at once he was watching a summer game in Chicago. There's about 3,000 or 4,000 people in attendance, and he had heard that there was like 20,000 at this Negro League game, and saw this more as as broadening the fan base than any.
I don't know whether there ever was one incident that convinced Rickey of that. He was an astute baseball man, a smart businessman. And again, I don't think it's incompatible to have strong moral principles and be opposed to segregation, as I think he was, and also wanting to make the profits and the money that would come in. Jack be nimble, Jack be quick, Jack makes the turnstile stick. Quick, Wendell Smith would say, and he's right. You know, and Rickey recognized that.
Yeah, and when integration began, and then we see that correctly as a piece with the dissolving, although often violently and not as quickly as it should have, the boundaries of segregation. How long was it before this the prediction, the foreseeing of the Negro Leagues ending? Did they in fact end?
Practically in a blink of an eye. The Eagles in Newark are a good example. In 46, they draw record crowds. In 47, their attendance drops from like 120,000 down, seasonal attendance down to about 55,000. In 48, it's down into the 20s. In 49, they're no longer Newark team. They're in Houston. In 50, they're no longer a team. They go out of existence. It happened very quickly.
Hmm. And I was wondering, we have this wonderful stadium in Detroit, the old one, the Tiger Stadium, the old Briggs Stadium. And someone at one point mentioned the possibility of creating a Negro League again, or a black league. And and the response was, how could you do that again? What would you do, not allow white players?
Yeah, the things like that come out of necessity. The necessity there was the larger society telling them they couldn't be this, they couldn't be that, and we hope to pray and certainly expect that that will never happen again.
Sure. Well, I guess maybe a final comment from you, Lawrence Hogan. This is you know, certainly a service both to sports, to history, to you know, to racial justice, your book. Is there more to it? Is there more to the story?
Well, there is, but I would hope that it's also a blessedly good read, because the storytelling side of black baseball is a wonderful part of it. the lore and the legends and the sometimes the exaggerations, which we know are, but that's part of the game too. So the book is filled with those kinds of stories. I'm very pleased that it turned out that way through the editing process that we went through with National Geographic.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I don't know if I even said that it's published by National Geographic, which is quite a compliment in and of itself, a prestigious publisher such as them. Shades of Glory is the book, The Negro Leagues and the Story of African-American Baseball. Bud Selig, Commissioner of Major League Baseball, says, an incredible story. It is now time to remember these players and celebrate their contributions to American history. That's what Lawrence D. Hogan and his team of writers have done. Thank you so much for being with me on The Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
This is WRIF.com.
Right on, you rock.
Here at 1 minute on the Riff.
Buy it the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Download it right to your PC.
Your Riff Rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. You know, I know most of you know there's other countries in the world, right? And there's people in them, much like you and I, have a lot of the same concerns. Similar institutions, particularly in North America and Western Europe. And yet our information, our knowledge of those other countries and what's going on there is so limited. And I'm not making accusations at you, dear listener, because the same holds true with me. Well, we're fortunate enough to have a guest with us in the studios here that comes from Northern Ireland, and she is going to apprise us what's happening in her country, what has brought her to the United States. She's Patricia Campbell. She's the vice president of the Independent Workers Union. She's a political and trade union activist. She's the, as I said, the vice president of the Independent Workers Union with special responsibility for dealing with the six Northern northern counties of Ireland, as we know it as Northern Ireland. She's also deputy editor of the Irish Republican magazine Forthright. And recently she's guided a struggle by fishermen up there to secure better conditions. Patricia Campbell, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you.
Now, you notice I was reading this, and I stayed studiously away from the name of the lake, the shores of, how do you say?
Loch Ness.
Loch Ness. Okay. I wouldn't have guessed it from there, but then that begins to show you the level of lack of information. And welcome to the United States. Welcome to the Detroit area. And you're on tour of the entire U.S. or just this area?
Well, I have toured Detroit. I was in Philadelphia last week, and I'm going now to New York on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've come quite a ways, and what's the purpose of your visit? I see that you were speaking at Mary Grove College, where you spoke of the role of women in conflict.
That's right.
Is that pretty much...
Well, I have had several audiences. I spoke on the state of the political process in Ireland, in Philadelphia. I have met many women's groups. I have met Palestinian representatives at the Palestinian office in Detroit. I will be speaking tonight at the Institute.
The International Institute, right?
Yes, had forgotten. And I'm also meeting people from the labor movement. I was invited by people from Solidarity, fellow trade unionists, to do this tour, and I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, and that's kind of unusual. It used to be back in the day that there would regularly be visitors from Europe particularly that would and invited by trade union groups, but this actually is something I haven't experienced in quite a while. What is this something you do on a regular basis? I mean, do you travel much to other countries?
Well, this is the first tour of this kind, and it's a unique opportunity for me to not only brief people on the situation of the trade union situation in Ireland, but also the political situation. I have been invited by Solidarity, many people who are in the UAW here,
mm-hmm.
and we find ourselves with many similarities, the trade union movement in Ireland, we find that there are many similarities with the trade union movement in the United States. And if I could just explain, Peter, that in the Republic of Ireland, we are moving towards a creation of a new social partnership arrangement in the Republic. The power of capital is growing in Ireland, and it is hard to avoid that the leadership of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions is now so conservative and timid. It is afraid to challenge the bosses and the state. I have spoken at length with UAW members and former former senior representatives, and they feel that the UAW is just an arm of the state and is not meeting the needs of workers here in the United States. We find that the Irish trade union movement in Ireland is similar to that, and we formed a new trade union, the Independent Workers Union, 2 years ago. I am very privileged to be vice president of that union. We are independent, being the word that is that I want to pronounce, because we are outside of the ICTU. And we do not agree with the social partnership because the social partnership doesn't meet workers' needs. There are those who would argue that it is a seat at the cabinet. and that you can make change within. And so far they have proven that it is not possible to make change within.
Now, this is in Ireland or Northern Ireland?
This is in the Republic of Ireland.
The Republic of Ireland, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Now, I would think that people that view the situation of labor in the Western world would have, many people would have similar criticisms, particularly from the left, of the inability of the trade union movement to stand up to what is happening, the deteriorating wage situation, protection, massive layoffs, outsourcing, job loss, deindustrialization. It certainly seems in the United States that labor organized labor, which is a smaller and smaller part of the overall workforce, is at a grave disadvantage and on the run. So this is nothing unusual here in the United States. I mean, this is the same situation you're seeing in Ireland.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, at the end of the day, it is the job of trade unions to stamp out exploitation. It's the jobs of trade unions to promote workers' rights and to ensure that workers have their rights, to ensure that workers have social and economic and political and individual rights, and no one should be afraid of that. You know, it's not just a trade union issue. It's about humanism. It's about people having rights. Why should anybody be afraid of that? And that's why I'm very proud to be part of the IWU, because we are building a trade union that will do that, and also that will give the membership the control.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead, finish.
You know, that the members will have a say, that the members will drive their union. And if I could just say, Peter, that trade union members employ people to represent them. So therefore, paid representatives are the employee of the members. So therefore, they should take direction from the members. And that is not happening in trade unions. There is no people power in trade unions at the moment. And the Independent Workers Union will address that issue and ensure that the members will be the union. The members are the union, and the members will direct the leadership.
Patricia Campbell is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. She's the vice president of the Irish Independent Workers Union. Mostly in the States today, union members such as myself that belongs to the Broadcasters Union, we're worried about that our unions will even continue to exist as they're with the industrial unions, with plant closings, as I said, outsourcing, that every day we read thousands and thousands of people lose their jobs. There's people dissatisfied with the unions decertify and weaken the base of trade unionism all the more. And yet you have I like what you're saying, but someone might say, well, gee, that sounds like more like the 1930s. You're talking about the rights of workers and stopping exploitation than it does in the realities of the beginning of the 21st century when, as I said, it appears for all practical purposes that labor is in great retreat.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very interesting that you say it appears like an era from the 1930s. And let us not forget that any rights that we have were... You know, the masters and the bosses didn't come and say, you are entitled to sick leave, you are entitled to annual leave, or vacation as they say here in the USA, you are entitled to maternity leave, you are entitled to a stat day, you are entitled to work 37 hours a week or whatever accepted hours per week that people work.
That's long gone in the US, but
yes,
go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. But we, you know, they were not handed to us. Our predecessors had to struggle for that, and they struggled, and now we are seeing those rights being eroded, and it is up to us, up to trade unionists, up to ordinary people, to ensure that our predecessors' struggle is not in vain, and that we ensure that these basic human rights, basic workers' rights are adhered to. And I think that everybody can gain from that.
Patricia Campbell, is the situation in Ireland and in the six northern counties the way it is here, both jobs leaving the area for cheap wages overseas and deindustrialization? Is that a problem similar to what we're experiencing here in the United States, and particularly in the Michigan and Detroit area?
Oh, yes, I quite coming to the Detroit area was a real education for me, and I'd like to say a little bit about that. But first, I will say that the power of capital is growing in Ireland, and you know, there is no longer forced emigration. Christy Moore used to sang a song about our children are shackled by illegal status as they hide their head behind the Brooklyn Wall. Indeed, that was the experience of many Irish immigrants. Now the power of capital is growing in Ireland, and we're seeing a reverse situation. Many migrant workers are coming to Ireland, and they are unfortunately doing the low paid jobs, and there is a lot of exploitation in Ireland. And indeed, we in the IWU, the Independent Workers Union, have much experience of dealing with migrant workers who are exploited. And indeed, it is the job of the trade unions to stamp this exploitation out. Now, could I just say about Detroit? Brad Duncan from Solidarity gave me a tour of Detroit on Sunday. I drove from the east side of the city, or we drove from the east side of the city to Grosse Pointe, and I couldn't believe it that just a block down the road, it was like we were going into a different country. The east side of the city, the area, reminded me of Gambia. I was in Gambia a few years ago and witnessed terrible poverty, and it just reminded me of Gambia. And within 2 minutes, I was driving along, and I couldn't believe the change. It was like I had went into a different country. This side, by the way, is a black community.
And then.
Two different worlds.
Well, it really is, Patricia Campbell. You know, one of the things, too, and I wanted to get you to speak about this, in the States, people a long time ago have given up talking about capital and capitalism and the workers and exploitation, and that's why I mentioned that somewhat sounding like the 1930s, and the idea is that we are all in this together, and this is a classless society, although your tour of Detroit certainly disproves that. But there's nothing to be gained by that kind of conflictual presentation. And what we have to be doing is what, like the UAW is doing now, is working with the Delphi Corporation, or working with General Motors. So speak to us a little about the use of these terms that may seem a little outmoded to Detroiters.
Yes, well, that's a pity that it might be a little bit outmoded. Perhaps we could get them inmoded.
Okay.
And would like to make reference to a quote from Brad Duncan, who is a member of Solidarity. And I know there has been many great people who have made great quotes, but none greater than Duncan, than Brad Duncan. And there was something he wrote here, and I thought it was, it really inspired me. He said, "In a more just, the working class majority, immigrant and native born does the work of society. They do the farming, building computers, teaching children, serving food, writing poetry, driving trucks, designing buildings, and everything else you can imagine. The working class majority do it. It's their society, and they should have the power. Now, I would say this to all you listeners out there who are driving on your way home, who have taught children, who have served meals, who have built building blocks, who has wrote poetry, who has worked, got up this morning out of your warm beds to do your day's work. I would say this is your society. You should have the power. I do believe that there is a need for trade union representation to ensure that your rights are secured. And healthcare and education should not just be the reserve of the rich. It should be your reserve because you contribute to this society and you deserve it. And not only do you deserve it, you need it.
Patricia Campbell is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. She's the vice president of the Independent Workers Union in Ireland. Now, in the United States, for the last, I'm trying to do my math, probably for the last 75 or 80 years, people dissatisfied with the individual trade unions have always functioned inside of the trade union mechanism as caucuses, trying to change things from within. Now, tell me about the Independent Workers Union and how it relates to the already established union. If say there was something like that here, would I retain membership in the union I belong to, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and be a member of the IWU, or are you trying to create a new independent, as it says, workers union?
Yes. Well, I mean, people are allowed to be in as many unions as they like. Now, it's very early days for the IWU. We would like to think that perhaps, we're going to represent everybody. Everybody can join our union, but they can also, it's their choice if they want to stay in an alternative union, another union. It's very early days for us in the IWU. We are building. It is snowballing. It's very, very, we're very optimistic. We started off with just a few members. We have over 2,000 members now. And if we keep on snowballing like that and recruiting, I think we're going to be a force to be reckoned with.
You spoke at Marygrove College here in Detroit a couple of days ago on the role of women in conflict. What was the subject matter here, in general in society or in the trade union movement or both?
Well, I come from the six counties of Northern Ireland, and I was born into a conflict that has recently ended. Well, the conflict has ended anyway. I've had many experiences of campaigns during that conflict. I spoke to a number of students at Marygrove College. I spoke to them about how women were written out of history, and how I am involved in a project at the moment with the former Mid-Ulster MP Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey. And Bernadette and I felt that the experiences of women had been written out of history, so we decided that we need to do something to ensure that the experiences of women over the last 30 years would not be written out of history. So we are currently involved in a project, in a piece of research, and we are interviewing women from three generations. My mother's generation, my mother is 73 years old. She had children born into the conflict. My generation, and I was born into the conflict. I was only about 10 years old when the first civil rights march from Coal Island, a town near where I live, the first civil rights march from Coal Island to Dungannon. I have very, very little memory of that. I remember my parents going to civil rights marches, but I have very little memory of the civil rights struggle. And then we're interviewing young women, sort of 20, 18, 20, up to about 25, and they will have memories of the conflict ending and childhood memories of the conflict. I think it's a very worthwhile part of a very worthwhile project to ensure that women's experiences of those times are documented and recorded, and no one will be able to come and revise that type of information. No one will be able to say that didn't happen. No one can revise personal experiences.
You know, maybe what I'll do right now is give a couple of the websites that you can reach the Independent Workers Union. It's union.ie. And also, you can read a lot of Patricia Campbell's writings at Forthright, like FourthWrite.ie. Pardon me. And I will have a link to those on my website, peterwerby.com. And, boy, I have about 27 more questions and time for about two. Time has really gone by with Patricia Campbell. Now, abortion is still illegal, both in the Irish Republic and Northern Ireland. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And yet there is many activists from the right wing that would like to abolish abortion in the United States again, and thinking that would end abortion. Are there no abortions taking place in Ireland because they're illegal?
No, abortion is illegal.
I'm sorry, illegal, yeah.
Illegal,
yeah.
North and south in Ireland. It's not really a massive issue. It's not a big issue because we are so close to Britain.
Oh, I see.
Might I add that I remember a song when I was very young that used to state, "Thank God we're surrounded by water." But we're so close to Britain, and women seeking abortion will travel to Britain, and many women do travel to Britain.
I have about just 30 seconds on a question we probably could have done the whole show about, and that's will the peace in Northern Ireland last?
Well, the conflict is over. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have peace. I think that there's a lot of work to be done to ensure that people get economic and social and political rights. I would like to talk more on that too, but unfortunately we're running out of time.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Patricia Campbell has been my guest. She's the vice president of the Independent Workers Union. And again, it's union.ie and also Forthright, the FourthWrite.ie. And I will have a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Thanks for your visit to the United States, and thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Think you have what it takes to be the next Riff Rock Girl? 101 WRIF and the Tri-County Pontiac GMC dealers, along with MGM Grand Detroit Casino, are looking for one very special woman to be the 2006 Riff Rock Girl. Think you can handle a $30,000 year-long contract? How about your choice of a new Pontiac or GMC? A Riff ad inside Stuff magazine? Oh, yeah. And you'll be a star in a Riff TV commercial. Go ahead and mark it in your day planner now. The first casting call to find the Riff Rock Girl
Girl will be at March 4th between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. at GameWorks inside Great Lakes Crossing in Auburn Hills. If you're 21 or older, bring your bio and a photo of yourself to one of the Riff's three auditions. For more details and official rules, visit WRIF.com. Are you the next Riff Rock Girl? The 2006 Riff Rock Girl Search. Presented by Tri-County Pontiac GMC Dealers. Also brought to you in part by MGM Grand Detroit Casino, where the city shines. And 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Job for her.
And they all lived happily ever after.
Our first Riff Rock Girl casting call is Saturday, March 4th at GameWorks inside Great Lakes Crossing in Auburn Hills. The Riff Rock Girl Search is on.
I can't get enough.
Everything rocks. That rocks.
Cowboy. Cowboy.
I'ma head out west where real women come equipped with scripts and fake breasts. Find a nest in the hills, chill like Flint. Buy an old drop top, find a spot to pimp. Then I'm a kid, rock it up and down your block. Go with a bottle of scotch and watch lots of crotch. Buy a yacht with a flag saying chillin' the most. Then rock that beast, jumping down the coast. Give a toast to the sun, drink with the stars. Get thrown in the mix and tossed out of bars. Sip the Tijuana. Shop.